Well, Uriah Heep, named after that famous Dickens character. But Stealing, in honor of Stealing Rembrandt's first hour, and a little bit more on Coast to Coast. Back to your open line calls coming up in just a moment. Kind of reminds me, before I left for New York today, I was talking about this tour that's going around the country. Night Ranger, Foreigner, and Journey together on the same stage. A few guys in Journey kind of left from the original lineup, or close to the original lineup anyway. Only one guy left from Foreigner that was part of the original band, and that's Mick Jones. He used to be in another band that sounds a little bit like Uriah Heep, Spooky Tooth. And then, but all the other guys are all gone. All of the other original members of Foreigner. Lou Gramm is still with us, but he's ill. He's still, I think, recovering from brain cancer. But Mick Jones, who's 67 years old. Gosh, and apparently owned the stage. I didn't go to the show, but said people that everybody I know that went said Foreigner was the best of everybody there. Sang their hits great. Place was rocking. And Mick Jones is 67 years old. I thought he was old when I was a kid. And he's still having at it. So kind of fun. Maybe coming to your town soon. It's a sellout. It was the other night. And I think a lot of people went to go see Journey and walked away a Foreigner fan. And then coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, I've got some fun bumpers planned for the subject of the debt ceiling. Been working on that tonight already, and we'll see how the rest of that show goes. First hour, we'll talk about Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and we'll talk about it with an ape expert, and just what is possible. Just how smart can apes get, or have they have already gotten? And you didn't even know about that yet. A little cautionary tale in this new movie. I'll save the rest of the discussion for tomorrow night. But I put a film review up on my Facebook page if you want to go over there and sign up. Love to have you. And I'd love to have you be an open line caller. Already got them all lined up here for this moment, but we'll get one cleared so that you can grab a call too next. On Coast to Coast, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Ponet. All right, we start west of the Rockies, where Kurt is in Albuquerque for open lines on Coast to Coast. Kurt?
Oh, hi, Ian.
Hey.
My ears kind of picked up when you talked about finding that book on Eagle's Nest.
Yeah.
My dad was a combat cameraman in World War II, and he worked under George Stevens' direction. They had
sure. They mean the Hollywood director?
Yes, they had
right.
Five like Jeep units with about four guys in it: a driver, a writer, a cameraman, and an assistant cameraman.
Hmm.
And my dad was a cameraman, and he was involved in the invasion of Normandy and the Battle of the Bulge and liberation of Dachau. And
was he there when they lost all the film from Normandy?
They had like little 100-foot load handheld cameras and a carbine, and they were running around in little units that sort of separated, and so they kind of scattered throughout the war front. They were right with the troops right in the beginning of it.
Sure. But, well, here's what I always heard about there's very little footage that actually survives of the invasion of Normandy, even though, as you just said, there were lots of cameramen out there and crews, and it was going to be a very important thing for the Allies to have documented in film. But as I always understood it, I mean, and this could be wrong, but all of that film was collected on the beach after the invasion was successful and there was no more shooting. And they loaded it into a boat and were taking it out to one of the larger ships that were just waiting offshore. And as they were moving all of these film canisters up from the boat up onto the ship, either a wake from a passing boat or a wave or something, the boat got rocked, and all of those canisters ended up on the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, I know.
And, right? And that was it. I mean, then there was no other way to recapture it. The Nazis weren't taking any film of it, so they didn't have anything. So that's why we only have, like, like 30 seconds worth of film from D-Day. But that wasn't your dad that lost them over the side of the boat, was it?
No, there was actually a colonel on the boat that didn't want to be around, and they'd bring the film back to the ship. And he said, I'm going to take this film back to London because it's very important. He jumped on a boat with it and took off because he didn't want to be around. But when they got on shore later, when they were moving through Europe,
sure,
he had an assistant with him. It was assistant cameraman. And so free time that they had, he would take still photographs. And they were at Eagle's Nest, and he made up three different books. One was about Eagle's Nest, one was on Dachau, and one was on the liberation of Paris.
Hmm.
We have those books here at the house. They're getting
oh, wow.
But I don't know if the one you found, did it have like a blue spiral plastic binding and plexiglass covers, like about 6x10?
Well, you're getting a lot of it right. I would say it was about 6x10. It was a spiral bound.
Right.
But it wasn't that. That's about all. Other than that, it was black cardboard pages, much like you'd see in any other, photo collection book, any kind of sort of memory book. Some of the photos that were in this, and again, we're just talking about something my brother and I found once when we were kids. And we think that they were just photographs that were taken by troops that were coming through. A lot of the photographs aren't very good. They're kind of fuzzy. They didn't look very professional anyway, but this guy had saved them, and for whatever reason, his family just threw him out. And
sounds like it may be.
To this day, I have them.
Part of the set there, they had one picture with a giant picture window at the Berchtes Garden at Eagle's Nest up there. It was
right.
Blown out with a bunch
knocked
of soldiers.
The glass out.
A bunch of soldiers standing in the
yep.
opening.
That's one of the, I think there's a photograph very much like that in what I have too.
And there's a guy sitting in a lawn chair out in front of the place in an army uniform.
Well, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but that sounds very familiar. So okay. Yeah, maybe they're all copies of the same role.
There's only about four or five sets made up. One of them has all pictures of Dachau with the horrible things that happened there when they got in there and liberated it. And the other, the troops coming into Paris. Liberation of Paris. So,
well, that's again, not... very cool thing. And that was your dad then that was coordinating a lot of that.
Yeah, he's 95 years old now. I don't think there's hardly any other guys in any of those units that are still alive.
I can't imagine. No, statistically, I think you're safe in saying that. Well, tell him that we talked about it on the radio and we're still proud of the good work that he did, and let him know that it mattered then and now. And thank you. And Wildcard Line. Let's go to Nick in Kauai on Coast to Coast. Nick?
Aloha, Ian.
Aloha.
There's a gentleman that called earlier. He mentioned the White Architect and reminded me about an old book that I found, a little treasure from the past here. I don't know what it's worth, but it's the first edition. It was printed in the copyright 1880. And the it's a Harper's School Geography book, and it's fascinating because I mean we're talking to something that's 130 something years old now.
Sure, yeah.
And it's amazing to read through it because you can see how the propaganda machine was getting revved up, or even back then, you know.
What do you mean by that? What is it? What do you see in it?
Well, maybe propaganda is not the right word, but just sort of the getting the students' minds going in a certain direction. Okay, here's a couple examples. Under I just had it here. Hang on 1 second. Under the social political structures, the races
right.
of men. One of the chapters is the races of men. And they talk about, this is kind of what they call that call trigger. It reminded me of, hold on 1 second, I just had the page marked here. Golly. Give me 1 second. Okay, here it is. Here we go. Races of men. There's the number of inhabitants upon the earth at this time was about 1,450 million. They were guessing. And they're divided into five great races: the Caucasian, the Mongol, the Ethiopian, the Malay, and the American, or Indian. The Caucasian, or white race, is the most widely spread. It occupies Western Asia, Europe, it says. It is the most restless, intelligent, and powerful of the races, and includes all the great historic nations.
Wow, there's what we call ethnocentrism right there, isn't it?
Just a little bit, huh?
Yeah.
And it's also really fascinating because they call the Americans the American, which is one of the races. And
sure, would be the Native Americans.
I mean, the Indians, right? Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And so I thought that was kind of interesting.
Oh, wow, that's very interesting.
You talk about the political geography, the conditions of society. We have nations and tribes. Savages, barbarians, half-civilized nations, and enlightened nations. And I'll just skip right to the enlightened nations.
Okay.
Those are the ones that are those civilized nations that possess a thorough division of labor, have established general systems of education, have made the greatest progress in knowledge and morality. Hmm. And many nations are partly in two or more of the classes, blah, 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 blah. All the little subtext, actually, is the fine print of the best
part. Right. That's very interesting, and I totally get where you're going with that. And thank you, Nick. That idea of trying to establish a standard, and that the American standard was the best. And I think you could still make an argument. I'm not interested in saying that we aren't great or that America isn't the best, but. You can see where in a nation full of immigrants there in the late 1800s, when that book was being printed, it was really important to try to get kids, if you pardon the pun, on the same page. And that's why we have the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag that comes up a little bit later on, and why we have, you know, a lot of singing and a lot of ritual to try to make sure that everybody is on board the American experience. This was back when we thought of the American experience as, you know, a melting pot instead of the fine stew that I think is the more common understanding now, where we can retain the original flavor of our carrotness or our potatoness or whatever, but still be part of a larger serving. So I'm kind of a stew guy myself. But east of the Rockies, David is in Syracuse on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Dave.
Oh, Ian Ponnett. Guess
hey.
What book I found? This was sort of relevant today. 1943 edition of The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand, my favorite author.
You found one?
Yes, and I've read Atlas Shrugged 25 times so I could help form my mind. And
right.
It's taken me to almost now to really get in the fast lane.
And well, I'm glad to hear that. But so you found you said, like, am I right? And did I hear you right? And you said, like, a first edition?
Yes. Well, the thing is that I asked Barbara Brandon, who wrote The Passion of Ayn Rand, too. And this one has, I guess, sort of a little green binding thread. There's another one that's red that I guess is worth more.
All right. But that's still cool. Where'd you find it?
It was in a bookstore down in New York, I think. No, where was
that?
No, it was no. I think Canandaigua or something. I don't know.
Okay.
I lived in Canandaigua, the chosen spot.
Sure.
About 15 years.
I used to go there all the time. Actually,
I love Canandaigua.
My grandmother lived there at Lake Canandaigua, and we used to go to the was it the Roseland Amusement Park?
Yeah, used to be there when I was there.
Right. Always went there. Never missed it. Every year. That was the highlight always of our summer, was that one day that we got to go to that Roseland Amusement Park. Well, thank you so much for jumping in. And I'm going to ask Dan back in the studio to tell me what we have coming up next on Open Lines. I can get one in before the bottom of the hour. I'm sorry, what was that, Dan? Casey in Wisconsin on Coast to Coast. And that'll take us up to the bottom of the hour, and we'll give you the numbers again to help take us home tonight. And Casey?
Yes.
It's Open Lines.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Where do you want to take us?
Well, I was just wondering if you were aware of the Chupacabra situation unfolding in Wisconsin.
Not in Wisconsin. I live not too far from you, so you'll have to tell me more about that.
Oh, well, it's been all over the news, I guess, for the past week or so. apparently someone, I believe, we've seen in the last week or two, someone found something dead on the road, and nobody's been able to identify it yet. They have really clear pictures that are actually, I'm pretty sure they're on the internet by now. But they've been playing it every day on the news. And then apparently 2 days ago, there were some children out playing in a ball field, and they got pretty close to one. I guess it ran right next to one of the boys, and he was about 5 feet away. And, you know, there's been people that, I guess, have called and said, well, that's just a raccoon with mange. But, you know, the kids weren't falling for that, and neither am I.
Well, hang on a second, though. I mean, back up. So a raccoon, that's way smaller than what a chupacabra is supposed to be. So how are why are we jumping to chupacabra with something as big as a raccoon?
I don't know. All I know is that the pictures that they've been showing on the news, they really don't resemble anything that I'm used to seeing. You know, I'm somewhat of an outdoorsman. I get out there, you know, I'm familiar with all the wildlife in all the surrounding states here, and I've never seen anything like this.
Well,
even if
I mean,
it was an animal. What's up?
I'm kind of hip to the idea that there's something going on in Wisconsin, and I'm trying to pull up some pictures of it even as we speak. Yeah. Oh, I see something. I see now. Yes. This is actually from last fall. This one is of a, could a chupacabra be in southeast Wisconsin? And it looks like a fox maybe, or a coyote a little bit. It's kind of a fuzzy image. Can't quite tell. So this has been going on for a while then, the idea that there could be a chupacabra somewhere in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, apparently the guy still has it in his freezer. So if anyone wanted to do tests, you know, it's there for the asking. I guess he was approached by a scientist from Ohio or something. But yeah, you know, I'd kind of like to see somebody get to the bottom of this.
What was his reason for not handing it over to scientists right away?
I guess he hadn't been approached. I don't know. This doesn't seem, you know, like a very big sense of urgency here. And I just, you know, I'm curious myself.
Okay, wait a second. But you're telling me you couldn't drive. I mean, I know Wisconsin. I mean, you get in a car, you get to your local university extension service in like 10 minutes.
That's what I'm saying. You know?
Yeah. Oh, that's so weird. You know what? It is open line. So who knows? Maybe somebody else will jump in and we'll get more on that. But I will tell you, I mean, I listen to and I consume Wisconsin state news frequently, and I hadn't heard any mention of a chupacabra lately. I kind of feel bad. All I'm hearing about is the recall votes that are going on because of the budget battles that they've been having there in Wisconsin, kind of like what the budget battles were having on a more national scale. We didn't get any resolution today. And we may or may not have any by the drop-dead date coming up August 2nd. Some people maintain that that's a phony date. It won't mean anything. Other people say they're pretty sure nothing bad will happen. I'm not in the mood for pretty sure myself. My wife and I have been thinking about putting our house on the market. That's the last thing we need. Tank the housing market just as we're about to drop a for sale sign in front. I'll go back and I'll see if I can't find more about the most recent chupacabra sightings in Wisconsin here while we give you the numbers coming up. And maybe you know something about that too. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, Open Lines, this is Ian Ponett. Well, there you go. And I'm getting double vision right now trying to find these chupacabra photos in Wisconsin. I think I found what the caller was referring to, but that's what open lines are for too. So you can fill in some of the blanks we've got going on tonight. Never heard back from anybody about a UFO sighting over Utica, New York. Still have time to get to that before the top of the hour. And we wrap things up for tonight, only to come back for Howard Bloom tomorrow night. And we will unpack the debt ceiling crisis. What is Howard, who's an expert on these things? What does he think will happen if we don't raise the debt ceiling? Now, it may be totally crisis averted, but could there be some residual damage just from all of this posturing, all this hemming and hawing over what we're going to do? Could that end up having, just even on itself, just that have a negative effect? We'll talk about that coming up tomorrow night and find out whether or not the debt ceiling could lead eventually to the rise of the Planet of the Apes. We'll ask Howard about that, too, coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. And your calls as we wrap up open lines next. And for George Norrie tonight, this is Ian Punnett. 5 Hour Energy is a good product. I do like that one, by the way. Mike is in Covington, Louisiana. Wildcard line, open lines on Coast to Coast. Mike?
Hello, Ian.
Take us home. Oh, nice to have you, too. Yeah, go ahead. Come on now. Take us home okay. In the last half hour here.
All righty. Speaking of Planet of the Apes, A to B to C, I had talked to you in the past about the primate center that we have here locally, and that brought me to the conclusion of all the interesting things that have happened in my life. Whenever I tell people stories about, you know, different things, they and some things I've shared with y'all, that I should write a book. And,
right.
I was wondering about your opinion on such a thing as writing a book about, you know, say, my life. Would I have to change the names to protect the guilty and the innocent? And, I mean, is there any direction you could point me with that?
Sure. Well, first of all, you may not have a choice over that. If you found somebody who was going to publish it for you, they would give you direction on, depending on the saltiness of the story. They wouldn't let you publish something that'll get them sued. So you don't have to worry about that so much. If you publish it yourself, you might want to err on the side of caution by changing names of people. But, you know, you really have to be doing something that's damaging to somebody's reputation, not just telling a true story. You have to do something in such a way that you knew as an author would compromise their ability to, say, you know, conduct their daily business. So it does get into some kind of murky areas from what I understand about the law. We do talk a lot about this in broadcasting as well as print. But then the larger question is, who's going to be your market, Mike?
Well, I don't want to give away too much because, you know, there's some issues too. Like, I had called in anonymously about some of the stuff I've called you about. And, you know, that's one of my biggest fears is that I did get successful in publishing and then disappear shortly after getting an agreement, you know. you know, there have been some things that have tied into my life that are very sensitive to some people. But in regards to that, I'll say this much, you know, there is some stuff involved with the JFK conspiracy that has crossed over into my life. And I think some people would find that stuff very interesting.
Well, you don't sound that old. How old were you when the JFK conspiracy happened?
I wasn't even around for that. However, it involved my mother, and, you know, she had been involved in that. And by virtue of that, growing up in the house and being exposed to the constant, you know, oh, this happened, that happened. And, you know, for a while, I didn't think it was very accurate, you know, and then I found evidence to back it up.
That's interesting. Well, whatever you come up with, I mean, you know, there are lots of ways to go. If you're going to go with a national publisher, you need to find an agent, period. Uh-huh. And you won't even get a look without an agent. If you're going with a regional or a smaller, like a local publishing house, there's not much money in it, but they'll give you a lot more freedom and they'll give you some direction, but maybe even not as much as you need. And then, you know, on top of that, if you're going to self-publish, there's ways to do that. You just have to have distribution in mind on the other end to make sure that once you got the product, you have a way of finding who wants to read it. But good luck with you on that. I'd like to hear more about it if it ever happens. Wildcard line, Shirley is in Washington on Coast to Coast. Shirley?
Hi, Ian.
Hey.
I have my husband's mother was a stage and movie star in the early 1900s. His father was a director, and he spent most of his career flying around the world, World War II, and Korea. So I have a lot of things that belong to his mother, his father, things that he brought back from.
Sure.
But once it really perked up my ears, I had something else I was going to talk to you about, but was the gentleman that called in about the natural star sapphire.
Right. The Star of Texas, I think it's called.
Yes. Well, I have a ring that belonged to my husband's mother. It was given to her by some movie director back in the early 1900s. I have a picture of her wearing it. And it's probably about 32 carats. And I've had it appraised, but it certainly didn't come in at the price that that man's did.
Right, right. Well, you know, that is the, you know, there's fluctuations regionally for something like that. That would make sense, though, right?
Well, I'm sure, of course, I live in a very, very small area. And so I don't know if maybe somebody didn't really realize just maybe how valuable, it may be more valuable than I think it is.
Well, you know, though, just to say it again, I mean, that's where you get a good cell phone picture, good cell phone camera photo of something, and you start sending it around and get different feedback from people saying, you know what, I'd like to see that in person.
Well, I've had it appraised, so I have pictures of it from, I believe, from the appraiser. But another thing I have is I have a model airplane, and it was used as a prop in the original Hell's Angels movie. And my husband's father was one of the directors on that, making that movie by Howard Hughes.
Right.
And I have a book stating that, you know, he was one of the directors. But it's a Sopwith Camel, and it's pretty good size, probably about, I don't know, 22 inches wingspan.
Yeah. Right. It's pretty big. Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, you know, whether it's movie memorabilia, I mean, I wish I were enough of an expert to be able to tell you, but it does sound like something valuable. And with everybody finding treasures these days and the economy being what it is, I say we find every way we can to turn that into money. So good luck, Shirley. And again, if you want to, you can sign up for my Facebook page and leave a message there, and I can update you or everybody on the air when we find out more about those stories west of the Rockies. Tim is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast as we're counting down the minutes to the top of the hour. And Tim?
Hi, Ian. I wanted to tell you about an interesting angle to the art theft discussion.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's this thrift shop in Phoenix down on Indian School Road here, and my girlfriend Patricia and I go there all the time, and it's the size of an airplane hangar. And when they first opened it, they had some incredible things, especially paintings, that they didn't know what they had, really. So, you know, I picked up something for $7, and I looked on the back of it. It looked like one of the grossest pictures you could find, because it's got a picture of a guy holding something up, and it looks like something coming out of his backside that looks like diarrhea.
Right.
And on the back of it, it had a little label that said, Don Quixote by Salvador Dali. And here's a signed in pencil.
Huh.
It looks like looks like the word Dali. And so I did some research, and they just happened to be having a free appraisal of things at the Phoenix Art Museum. And this guy says, you know what, this could be a Dali, but it is a poison art market, because there are thousands of lithographs of Dali that are out there that were actually counterfeited. And what happened is members of Dali's family got a hold of the original lithograph stones, I believe, and they were putting out this phony art. And
right.
There's actually a book written about it. So he didn't think much about this picture. I looked up online, and this particular series, they were wanting $8,000 a piece on an online European art gallery. And then I decided, well, let's try and sell it for a reasonable price on the internet, through this one antique dealer, and we couldn't get a decent price. Finally, there was a traveling memorabilia outfit, you know, they buy sports memorabilia, that type of thing, and they gave me $200 for it. But we still don't know if it was original, but in the book he says his earliest lithographic work was apparently not subject to this scandal. And this was his very first series that he did. And what he did was he had some kind of a disdain for public art. Because what he did is he started slashing the lithograph stone, and he shot bullets into it and so forth.
Well, it sounds interesting.
Instead of these beautiful surrealistic images like the melting watches, it looked like a piece of junk. But
that's cool, though. That's very cool. And again, this is the whole reason why I threw it out at the beginning. And thanks, Tim. What are the hidden treasures that you've got in your home? I just didn't realize we'd have as many people have them. And how many of them had to do with famous art of one type or another? John is in Terre Haute, Indiana, on Coast to Coast. John?
Yes.
Hey.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. We can get you in before the top of the hour.
Okay. I was just wondering if you are familiar with the book called Journey of Souls.
Journey of Souls. No, tell me about that.
Okay. It's been a while since I've read it, but I think the basic gist of it is it's written by a guy who's a hypnotherapist, and he has case studies outlined in his book to where he takes people, you know, takes people under and gets them to recall past lives that they
past regression therapy, it's called. Yep.
Okay. Yes. And I was just wondering basically what your opinion is on that.
Right.
And
well, thank you for asking. I'll tell you just candidly, I actually had experienced some hypnotism lately. I have kind of a terrible case of tinnitus. And I thought it'd be interesting, among the many things I've been trying, is that I would try hypnotism. And I'll just tell you, that was $150 nap is what I paid. I paid $150 to take a nap in a chair. And none of the post-hypnotic images or suggestions have ever taken hold, if in fact any were passed along. So I'm a little negative on the entire hypnotism thing right now. But your case sounds interesting. And did I lose him? That was John in Terre Haute. Let's do Brian in where was that again, Dan? Brian was in Kenosha. There you go. Brian?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, go ahead.
Yeah, actually one of your previous callers just kind of touched on it. I found a little treasure myself right out of high school. I was kind of in a bad way. I made a bunch of bad decisions. And I was kind of taking jobs wherever I could. And one of the jobs I picked up was cleaning out this house that somebody had moved out of. They left a bunch of stuff behind.
Right.
And in a stack of papers, I come across this piece of art. And it was just on a plain piece of paper, basically. And, well, it was, you know, a thicker piece of art paper. And I'm looking at it. I'm remembering something from high school, something from art history I took. And I can't quite place it. And a couple years later, I find it again. And I remember what it was. It was actually one of the El Cid, part of the same series as that Don Quixote done by Salvador Dali.
Hmm.
And so what I did is I had it appraised, I put it online, and it actually paid for my first two semesters of school where I went to go study for archaeology. So finding one treasure actually let me find more treasures.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I love that. It's these names, too. It's these big names, not just insignificant ones, but a lot of them out there. I hope everybody gets them appraised, and who knows, maybe just even make it a YouTube video. You don't have to do anything. Just put up a YouTube video, ask people, what is this? And then just refer people to the YouTube video so that they can see you walking through it and holding the painting up or the photographs or whatever it is and being able to go from there. John is trucking in Minnesota. If I hustle, I can get both my last callers in. Hey, John.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good. Where in Minnesota are you?
Heading towards Duluth.
Okay. So you're heading up 35 there?
Yep.
Yep. Very good. Okay. Well, be careful with that. And it's open line. So where do you want to take us?
I was asking about this UFO sighting. Was that on Wednesday night?
The caller said the other night. My impression was actually it was tonight, not, you know, like two or three nights ago, but earlier tonight or within the last 24 hours.
Okay, because Wednesday night, about 9 o'clock, I was about 20 miles south of Duluth, and there was a green flash that went across the sky. It didn't look like a falling star or anything like that.
Right. They got a lot of those in Duluth. Right.
I didn't know what it was, but it went straight across the sky coming east to west. It's pretty fast. I didn't really know
what it was.
Well,
in his case, he said they were orange objects, and they appeared to be about 40 of them. Well spaced, almost in like an attack formation. A plane came up from behind them. They dispersed, and that was kind of the beginning of the end of the experience, but it lasted for a long time, and he got a good look. at what he called the UFOs that he saw the other night, and was asking whether anybody else had seen them too. So thanks for trying, John, and appreciate that. And have a good time in Duluth, Minnesota, coming up tomorrow. Let me get to Mike, who's in Georgia, who'll be our last caller for tonight on Coast to Coast. Mike?
Hello, Ian.
Hey, we had to put our shoulders into the boulder to move it here to get you in on it, but you're here now, so lines.
I heard you talking about the art, so I had a couple of things, but one thing, I got this print from 1901. It's this really strange print that I had. Got it from a friend of mine. He was a professor up here, teaching at the college, and he's a friend of mine. He's passed away now.
Right. Which college in Georgia?
This is Georgia College in Milledgeville.
Okay,
and,
I know Milledgeville.
This was the original capital of Georgia.
I know it was. Named after the, wasn't he a colonel or a general?
Millage? Know, I don't know. I don't know.
I think
know.
He was. I think he was.
Actually, this was in his attic. He had two homes. He had one up in Tallulah, which Tallulah Gorge.
I've been up there. I spent a night at Tallulah Gorge. It's beautiful.
Well, I was down there. He was trying to, you know, we just used to go hang out with him. There was this print, and it's framed, and it was up in his attic, and I found it. He said, take it home with you. So I took it home, cleaned it up, you know, and it said 1901 on it. And I said, so, you know, I told him, I said, well, this is really old, Doc. That's what we used to call him, Doc. And I said, maybe you want it back because it may be worth something. He said, no, I don't care about it. Just keep it. And but I've tried to find out, you know, from, you know, anybody
sure.
and everybody,
right.
what is this print of this person? And they can't tell me. It looks like a saint. I thought it was a saint.
Right.
It's just a woman, and she has chains. She's like, and she's got these bracelet, these chains. She's standing in front of a cross.
Right. Well, you know, I couldn't tell you just by your description, but I would say, again, get a photo of it, put it up online, challenge people, put it on YouTube, put out a challenge going, what is this? Does anybody know? Get some traction going that way. You're going to get a lot of opinions. It's going to be, that's the fastest way to resolution, I think, but. It sounds great. So glad so many people have profited, made money. How about that guy? He's still got $55,000 from an etching, which he's waiting to cash in on. That's just cool. So tomorrow night, Howard Bloom is on. We'll be talking Rise of the Planet of the Apes in the first hour. And who knows, maybe this debt discussion and the Planet of the Apes discussion will end up tying together after all. We'll just wait until tomorrow night. Sign up for Deacon Punnett. My Twitter feed, and get on that Facebook page. We'd love to talk to you there, too. And thank you, George, for the opportunity to fill in. We'll do it again next Friday. Deus te amat, and I do, too.